Marketplace is supported by Wix.com, giving millions of business owners the ability to create their own professional website. You can create a website today online at Wix.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up today on the program, amid the crush of business news, there is a practical side to Ebola, how to train hospitals to get ready. Also, why Silicon Valley is going after your hamburger, and the bottom line on the wars in Iraq from somebody who was there. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Kronos, offering cloud-based workforce management solutions to help organizations of all types and sizes achieve their strategic goals. More at Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. And by Citrix GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device. More at GoToMeeting.com.
In New York, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 15th of October. Great, as always, to have you with us. There are some objective facts that need to be said here about Ebola and what is or is not happening. There is no Ebola epidemic in this country, and there is a vanishingly small chance that people not in direct contact with somebody who's infected will get sick. But yes, there are two healthcare workers, nurses who treated Thomas Duncan in Dallas, who have been diagnosed with Ebola, and at least partly as a result. National Nurses United sent a letter to President Obama today. The nurses union wants Washington to require, quote, uniform national standards at all U.S. hospitals to deal with Ebola. What that will take, getting every hospital, large and small, ready for a possible Ebola patient who might walk into the ER. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has that.
The nurses' union says those national standards should include the highest standard of optimal protections, including hazmat suits and hands-on training to protect nurses and other healthcare workers, even at the smallest of hospitals. Executive Director Roseanne DeMauro.
They are first line of defense. We would not send soldiers to the battlefield without armor and weapons.
Dennis Mackey is an infectious disease control expert at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says it takes at least a half a day to train people in the protective garb alone.
I've just gone through Ebola training in my own hospital for putting the garb on and off this week, and I can tell you that is a very complex undertaking.
35 different steps, according to Ashish Jha at the Harvard School of Public Health. Jha says proper Ebola training and equipment at every hospital in the U.S. will probably cost in the tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars overall. But not every hospital worker needs in-depth training.
I think every hospital person certainly needs to know something basic about isolation. And then probably every hospital needs a small number of staff who can stabilize and manage that patient for the short run.
In the short run, he says, until they can move the patient to a medical center with the staff and resources to safely care for an Ebola patient long term. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
There was an economic report out today that is, if you look at it right, both a long run and a short term indicator. The headline number on retail sales suggests we are moving in the wrong economic direction. Consumers actually spent slightly less in September than we did in August, but we are spending more than we did last year. Short and long. Perspective is everything, you guys. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes a look at what might be the new normal in retail spending.
As a marketing professor at Georgetown University, Marlene Morris-Towns keeps a close eye on retailers. She imagines right now they sound a lot like Chicago. Consumers seem to be spending less, and retailers are finding they need a lot more wooing than a few years ago.
I think that retailers are really, really kind of struggling to get people in, to get people shopping. I think they're pushing the holidays on us faster and faster.
Today's numbers might make retailers despair, but Towns is actually optimistic about consumer spending these days. There's just a big asterisk.
I really do feel that we are in a new normal.
Susan Villamari tracks consumers and retail trends for IRI.
The new normal is going to be a much more conservative mindset than what we saw before that proverbial bubble burst.
She says many consumers who cut back during the recession are keeping a tight grip on their spending. Omer Sharif, an economist at RBS Securities, says compare that with a decade ago when homeowners were pulling equity out of their homes or using credit cards to fuel shopping sprees.
So it's just a very different environment in terms of your ability to finance your expenditures. I mean, it's night and day versus 2004.
And that means consumers are largely limited to spending what they have. Sharif doesn't expect that to change anytime soon. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
About Wall Street today, I will say only this. As lousy as it was, and boy, it was, it could have been worse. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. HBO made an announcement today that's got the media and entertainment world buzzing. The company says that next year it's going to start offering its online streaming service, HBO Go is the brand name, to anybody who wants to pay for it, whether they've got the appropriate cable package or not. We've been spending some time on the future of television the past couple of weeks, into which subject this news certainly falls. It's a series we call Screen Wars.
No money down.
That one's in the dirt.
On a brighter note, commercial break.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. We turn to him when we have questions about stuff like this. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
This is, we should say, a big, big deal in the world of internet and television and cable and all that.
It is. It is. And you know what they say in Game of Thrones, right?
I don't know. I watch.
You win or you die. And you know, this is really about HBO winning over online viewers and also future online viewers. We don't know a ton yet. The CEO has promised, of course, that he wasn't going to do this, that HBO
right.
wasn't going to do this. And now they've changed. And I think that's probably because there's been a discussion behind the scenes about
right.
just what the lay of the land looks like.
Well, the lay of the land looks like 80 million people who don't have HBO, right?
Yes. But it also looks like me and my, you know, mom's cousin, sister, and everybody else stealing HBO Go from their, you know, from people that they know, because HBO Go is the only way you can stream this content. And so I think my guess is that HBO has been actually looking at the data on this.
Yeah.
There are some Scandinavian countries that already have a service like this.
Huh.
And so HBO has probably been looking at this and been trying to convince its parent company, Time Warner, to just let them bite the bullet, cut the cord,
huh.
and, you know, and make this happen.
Draw out the next steps for me, then. The reason people have pay cable TV, a lot of analysts will tell you,
yep.
is because of HBO and ESPN.
Oh, yeah.
Are we going to tomorrow afternoon hear ESPN come out and say, oh, us too?
Well, this could be the beginning of that, absolutely. It also is like, I think it's kind of bad news for cable companies. I mean, when I was growing up,
right.
it was like always going over to Ted's house because his parents paid for cable and paid for HBO, right?
That's right.
And this has changed. People's behaviors are changing. They're changing little bit by little bit. Some estimates only like 3% of people are going to cut,
yeah,
the cord,
cut the cord
next year. But those numbers are really growing fast for certain demographics, as you can imagine. And people's behavior is really changing.
The word we're looking for here is a la carte. That's what people have been saying, forever. Why can't
yes.
we unbundle all this cable and just get what we want when we want it? If I don't want to buy HBO, I don't have to buy HBO.
Yes.
Right? That's what this is?
That's what this is. And what's interesting is HBO has to be looking at Netflix, has to be
yep.
looking at Amazon and saying, these companies are just eating our lunch when it comes to people actually paying for specific subscriptions
right.
for content that they've created. HBO has content that is amazing, but nobody can get to it unless they have cable. For instance, Game of Thrones, once
yeah.
again,
yeah,
what
yeah.
can I say? I love swords, but that show...
No, I'm totally with you. And I'm a season behind because I don't have HBO because I don't want to
okay.
deal with the whole cable package.
See?
Thing. I don't want the gold premium level, right? I just want the HBO bit of it.
And what's interesting is, I don't know if you're a pirate, but HBO
I'm not, but okay.
is breaking records when it comes to piracy.
Oh, pirating HBO.
Yes,
I was like,
yes,
wait, what?
People are stealing Game of Thrones online.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And HBO knows about this. It's pretended for a long time that it doesn't care, but it's probably finally figured out, you know what? We got to start raking in some cash
yeah.
on this.
I'm no pirate. I pay for it. Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. Ben, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kai.
Not for nothing, but Netflix shares were off 25% today after hours on slower growth projections. We've got more from our series on the future of television at our website. It's marketplace.org. lot of what happens in Silicon Valley today and in the tech industry in general, no matter where a company is about disruption, about taking an existing business or industry and blowing it up. Uber is the now classic example of that. But there is a lot of interest in food at the moment. And there is a handful of startups that has the livestock industry in its sights. Marketplace's Quina Kim has that story.
Meet Patrick Brown. He's the CEO of Impossible Foods, a startup in Silicon Valley. Its goal? To disrupt America's $74 billion beef industry.
It's egregiously inefficient.
Brown's talking specifically about the big business of raising animals for food. He says worldwide, animal farming is one of the biggest consumers of water.
It's using 30% of the entire land surface of Earth, okay?
And that land is being cleared to make room for cattle to graze and to grow food crops.
It's the biggest driver of biodiversity losses in the world. Just to raise animals to make cheeseburgers. It's ridiculous.
Brown says we've been using animals to make food for 10,000 years, and that technology is outdated.
Livestock, it's a technology. We use the technology to take cheap plant biomass.
By biomass, you mean grass?
Grains, seeds, all the things that animals consume.
And they basically make it into meat. Brown says in 2014, we know how to extract nutrients and proteins from plants, and we can make meat without animals. And so Impossible Foods is one of a handful of tech startups that wants to make animal products from cheese to eggs and beef by using plants.
All right, so I'm going to put the patty on the grill here.
That's Beth Frixdale. She's a scientist at Impossible Foods, and she's frying up its most recent burger prototype.
You'll notice we've got this nice transition in color from red to brown.
You took the patty off the plate, and there's a little bit of, it looks like blood?
Yeah, it looks like blood, although this is not blood from an animal. This is blood from plant.
That's the color of the heme that I was telling you about.
Brown says heme, which is found on the roots of bean plants, is what gives meat its unique flavor. It's naturally red, and when you taste the heme raw, like I did, it tastes like blood. When the burger was done, I ate it, and if I tasted it at a fast food joint, I probably wouldn't have noticed a difference. At the same time, it's not as good as the grass-fed burger that I get at my favorite restaurant. And that's what Impossible Foods is going for. Andy Wheeler is with Google Ventures, which invested in the startup. He says while he'd like to go after the gourmet market,
it really is the mass market opportunity that's interesting.
Wheeler says to get into that market, Impossible Foods needs to make its ground beef cheaper than the real stuff. And that's a challenge. Right now, one Impossible Food burger costs about $20 to make. Despite that, Wheeler says a bunch of events have made investors more bullish on food.
We all see that obesity is a huge problem and people are getting more concerned with health.
And more concerned about sustainability. And Wheeler says that traditional food companies have been slow to address these concerns. And investors see an opportunity. They also think advances in science have made food more of a tech play.
So the company may be starting with the ground beef product, but the core technology they're developing around food science is really applicable to a really wide range of potential foods.
The idea of synthesizing real food is an age-old dream.
That's Michael Pollan. He's a food journalist and activist. And he says, think about Tang, non-dairy creamers, and Cool Whip. But Pollan says what's new this go-around is that techies are on a mission.
Which I think is distinct, and I think it's political. These companies aim to shrink animal agriculture because of its environmental footprint.
And Pollan applauds that effort. But he says,
I think you run into some of the limitations of Silicon Valley thinking when it comes to culture, which is that the pleasure of eating meat is not simply a sensory pleasure. Meat connotes prestige, and it does all over the world. Will fake meat offer that pleasure?
And while this new crop of food techies are using plant-based nutrients instead of, say, artificial chemicals like they did decades ago, Pollan says there's still reasons to be skeptical.
Foods that we've been eating for tens of thousands of years have kind of proven themselves out. And we are talking about introducing some novel foods. So, you know, we need to be careful.
But he says that's not to say we shouldn't do it. Pollan says we make processed foods for all kinds of reasons, for convenience, taste, and to make money. And so why not make it to save the environment? In San Francisco, I'm Quina Kim for Marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up,
the enemies of the United States that had watched us so thoroughly and frankly easily defeat the Iraqi army were never going to choose to fight us that way again. They were going to choose entirely different ways to fight.
The business of fighting a war, but first, let's do the numbers. There they are, the wah-wah trombones. You knew they were coming. Markets lurched lower today as fears of a global economic slowdown intensified. The Dow Industrials off 173 points, more than 1%, closed at 16,141. Believe me when I tell you that's not as bad as it was during the session. The Nasdaq spilled 11 points lower, 0.25%, ended things at 4215. The S&P 500 plowed under 15 points, 0.8%, 1862. Airline operators had a bumpy Ebola-related flight. United Airlines fell 1.4%. Today, Delta Airlines dropped 0.25%. Yes, Republic Airlines, rather, slid 0.9%. Apple down 1.2% today after details of the iPad Air 2 and iPad Mini 3 leaked out into the blogosphere, as they tend to do. Those devices were expected to be announced tomorrow. Google gapped down 1.3% after it unveiled several new Nexus devices, as well as an Android TV player. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Nuance Power PDF, designed for easy implementation to accurately convert, combine, and collaborate on business documents. Nuance.com/PowerPDF. PDF uncompromised. By Rice University's Jones Graduate School of Business, committed to transforming business thought through innovation, scholarship, and research. Learn more at business.rice.edu. And by Zillow, with homes for sale, historical pricing data, and photos all available on Zillow.com or on their mobile apps. Zillow, find your way home. Have something to say about one of our stories or want to suggest your own? Find us on Twitter at Marketplace or join us on Facebook to interact with producers, reporters, and the hosts of Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for September. Kenvention gets underway in Chicago. That's a convention dedicated to Ken, the doll. It's a wedding-themed event. Who could Ken be marrying? And according to some calendars, tomorrow is National Bosses Day. I'm not telling you how to observe that. Up to you. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's going to be something of an experiment going on in an NBA preseason game this weekend, the theory of which is this: less actually is more, as in less basketball. The Nets of Brooklyn and the Celtics of Boston will have just 44 minutes of playing time versus the usual 48 when that game starts. Marketplace's Dan Weissman looks at what the NBA hopes to get from giving its fans less of what they are paying for.
NBA officials mentioned our schedule as one motivation behind the experiment. That is, lots of games often means lots of injuries. So maybe shorter games could mean less wear and tear on players' bodies. Then again, maybe not. Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist at Smith College.
If, for instance, it's the case that LeBron James, out of a 48-minute game, plays 37 minutes, we don't know if he'll play proportionately fewer minutes.
So coach asks himself, if I can play LeBron 37 minutes a game without getting scared about injuries, why would I play him less in a shorter game? Okay, but what if fans and TV networks prefer shorter games? Glenn Wong teaches in the sports management program at University of Massachusetts Business School.
2 hours fits well in terms of fans and in terms of TV slots. I think there's a certain trend towards reducing the length of the game.
In particular, the final minutes of an NBA game can drag out like crazy. The 44-minute game would also cut one of 3 mandatory ad breaks in the fourth quarter. But what slows down those last minutes really is part of how the game gets played.
In the NBA, you can just keep fouling people and fouling people and fouling people and extending this and hope something's going to happen.
That's David Barry, a sports economist at Southern Utah University.
I think you could say that the game, in terms of actual chronological time, is too long, and you could take steps to address what's making it go longer. But just giving people less product
doesn't seem like such a hot idea. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
The news on the front page of the New York Times today was simply astonishing. That American soldiers had, in fact, found chemical weapons in Iraq as long as a decade ago. Weapons left over from Saddam Hussein's war with Iran. That some U.S. troops had been injured by those shells, and that the American government kept both the discoveries and the injuries secret. All of that comes against the backdrop of what has to be called deepening American involvement in the region, where we have already spent close to $2 trillion, if you're counting. John Nagel, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Army, retired, served in Iraq during the first Gulf War. He went back in 2003, fighting a very different kind of war, and then the Pentagon, where he helped write the Army's Manual on Counterinsurgency. His new book explores recent history, changes in policy, and his thoughts on the future. It's called Knife Fights, a memoir of modern war in theory and in practice. John Nagel, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Kai.
You started your military service at a time of, I guess you'd say, big army, right? I mean, you were a tank officer, an armor officer. You went to Desert Storm, and then you saw the ground sort of changing under your feet, almost quite literally.
Almost literally, absolutely right. So I had the privilege of commanding a tank platoon in Operation Desert Storm, a great war. We took the Iraqi army from the fourth largest in the world to the second largest in Iraq in a period of 100 hours, and that's initially what I thought war was supposed to be. That's the war I'd studied at West Point. It was right at the end of the Cold War. The Army was enormous. Tanks were a huge part of what the Army was. But later, when I reflected on that experience, when I tried to look at the battlefield from the other side, I realized that the enemies of the United States that had watched us so thoroughly and frankly easily defeat the Iraqi Army were never going to choose to fight us that way again. They were going to choose entirely different ways to fight.
From your preface, you write these words: "It is a tale of wars that needed to be fought and wars that were not necessary, but that happened nonetheless at enormous cost in blood and in treasure." I wonder whether you would add to that phrase credibility.
Oh, I think so. The United States squandered an awful lot of goodwill, as well as numbers of my friends' lives, literally trillions of dollars, by unnecessarily invading Iraq in 2003 and then doing it poorly on top of that after a very successful initial invasion, had no plan for what came next, for the occupation and the rebuilding of an Iraq. And St. Ignatius taught us that the only purpose of a war is to build a better peace. And perhaps the biggest problem I have with the U.S. government as a whole is that in the aftermath of the invasion of Iraq in 2003, it had no plan to build a better peace. And in fact, arguably, the insurgency that erupted in the wake of that invasion was a far, far worse situation for the people of Iraq and for the people of the United States than the pre-war situation had been.
Is it possible that your chosen specialty of counterinsurgency can be at least, since it looks like, given the current situation, Iraq is going to be home for many of us for years to come, can it be cheaper in terms of treasure?
It can be. An enormous part of the $2 trillion we now estimate we spent on the war in Iraq was wasted money, was money that was economic reconstruction aid given poorly, not given wisely. U.S. counterinsurgency strategy going forward, I think, is not going to be enormously expensive American troops on the ground doing the fighting, but host country forces, forces like the Iraqi army and the Kurdish army of today, assisted, enabled, empowered by small teams of American advisors. And so I think that we can reshape our military and our State Department, the U.S. Agency for International Development. Getting that organizational change to happen really does take a bureaucratic knife fight, and that's one of the reasons I chose that title for my new book.
Is there a fear that more American troops actually in Iraq and on the ground will be throwing good money after bad? Not to imply that what was spent there in fortune and treasure was bad, but clearly it was badly spent.
Much of it was badly spent, and so I believe that a relatively small investment of American blood and treasure now at this point will remove the need or reduce the need for larger investments later. Because the truth is that it is a vital national interest of the United States that ISIS, ISIL, be defeated and destroyed, as the president has correctly said is his goal. I just don't believe he's so far demonstrated a willingness to pay the price that it's going to take to achieve those objectives.
You know, it's funny. You had a piece in Politico this past weekend in which you called on the Obama administration to if it's going to do something in Iraq, really do it against ISIS or ISIL or whatever you want to call it. And I read down to your byline, that little blurb at the bottom there where it tells who you are. And it said, John Nagel is a veteran of the first two Iraq wars, almost like there's an expectation there will be more.
There clearly is another war happening in Iraq right now. 1,600 Americans are involved on the ground. Thousands more are involved from ships in planes, conducting strikes, doing intelligence analysis in support of that effort. It's clearly going to be another war. I don't think it's going to be as big for the United States as the last Iraq war was or my first Iraq war was. But the implications of the war and the necessity to get it right are just as big as it was the last two times.
The book by John Nagel is called Knife Fights, a memoir of modern war in theory and in practice. John, thanks very much for your time.
Good to be with you, Kai.
We have an excerpt of John Nagel's book, Knife Fights. It's on our website, marketplace.org. I will tell you, it comes highly recommended.
Marketplace is supported by MailChimp. More than 7 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to design and send email newsletters. More at MailChimp.com. By Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. Learn more at Moo.com. And by RingCentral, cloud business phone systems designed to meet the needs of today's mobile and distributed workforces. Learn more at ringcentral.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which the concept, yes, there is a market for everything, goes perhaps a step too far. Ebola.com. Number one, that domain name does, in fact, exist. Number two, the guy who owns it bought it 6 years ago for $13,500. Number three, the asking price right now, $150,000 American. Also, ugh. Anyway, in other news, better news. I am in New York for a live show that we are doing. It's called How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers. It is tomorrow night. Love to see you there. Delia Ephron, Misty Copeland, she's a ballerina, Hank Azaria from The Simpsons, Yancey Strickler from Kickstarter, whole lot more. David Brancaccio is going to be there, Rob Schmitz from Shanghai, me live on stage, 92nd Street Y, tickets at 92y.org. Come on by. All right, that is it. That is the broadcast today. The Dow off 173 points, more than 1%. The NASDAQ down 11, that's a quarter percent. The S&P 500 off 15 points, 0.8%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.